Welcome to Women and Sustainability, the podcast where we speak with some of the world's foremost female professionals from across the sustainability field, with me, your host, Emily Fripp. Today, I have great pleasure in speaking to Dieter Vind, an expert in the circular economy and zero waste design. Dieter is an entrepreneur, an author, a public speaker, angel investor and board member who regularly gives lectures on the circular economy. She's written two books about the subject, and her most recent being The Danish Design Heritage and Global Sustainability, which showcases practical examples of designing for a regenerative society. Dieter is also the founder of The Circular Way, the chairwoman of the Danish Design Council, and a member of the executive board of the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts Schools of Architecture, Design and Conservation. And along with this, she's also involved in the global SDG Innovation Lab Unleash. In this episode, we will learn about the circular economy and Dieter's journey to becoming a leading expert in the field. Good afternoon and hello, Dieter. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here with me today to have a chat and to learn more about your amazing work that you're doing and how you became sort of involved in this space, what drove you to become involved in it and the evolution of your career, but also how where we go from here and how it works. So you're the founder of Circular Way, which is the most fascinating sort of organization, and I can see you're very busy speaking at various conferences, writing things, sitting on chairs of different organisations. How and why did you end up where you are today? Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you got to and where you started from in terms of getting to where you are.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think actually, especially today, today is a different question than normally, probably because this morning, I was on social media and it like one of these pop-ups on like 7 years ago, you posted something. And today, 7 years ago, I did this conference with the Danish Design Council at the Danish Parliament on circular design. And what I wrote was that circular economy is in the capture for the post, circular economy is about more than using less and recycling more. It's also about designing systems change. And that was funny because I very much believe that, but I probably kind of forgot that that was also part of my understanding 7 years ago. Because in between that, I've kind of also had quite a lot of time of being in the sort of nitty-gritty of doing new innovation, so taking a waste stream and turning it into a material. And in that, sometimes maybe not being so aware of the systemic change also being needed at the same time. So that was just a bit of a fun coincidence of that sort of in when I talk about biogenic materials in my new book, I use this term of innovation by remembrance. And it's almost as if I'm sort of myself innovating by remembrance. So there's these sort of cycles of life. But nonetheless,
I saw that in one of your sort of speeches that you were giving, and you used that term, and I thought, what a brilliant term. What did you start out studying then? Where did you?
Yeah. So
is it design background or a sort of?
No, I actually don't have a design background, which is a bit odd. And I remember it's sort of like it's a designer is not a protected title, architect is not a protected title, engineer is not a protected title. So at like different points, people have been telling me that, but I am actually neither as such. I'm educated in a business background.
Okay.
And then just from a very tangible place, saw the opportunity that design gives us in this sort of we know what we, science has been very good at telling us what we need to leave behind, but design can help us shape what we move towards, both from a very sort of tangible product perspective, but also from the systemic perspective. So I invested actually in a circular business model back in 2014, which was a baby clothing product as a service business model. Of course, at that point, we didn't know that it was a circular economy. It just from the gut feel made so much sense that in a product as a service business model, you're actually incentivized to produce quality because the longer, you know, the better quality, the longer it lasts and the better numbers on your bottom line. But then becoming aware that it was circularity and then from there building a network around circular economy. And so always in this mixing between being engaged in industry from a more tangible, practical example and having this sort of more organizational meta level of how do we start working together, what's needed if we really want to bring about that change.
I'm really interested in the bit you just sort of said about the producing something of a better quality and therefore having a better positive impact on your bottom line. Because almost that's changing the whole way that business has been taught to think in recent years. And even yesterday, I was involved in a living income conversation for cocoa farmers. And everybody was debating, is it better to pay them a higher price for legal and sustainably produced cocoa or train them and enable them to grow more and then they can sell more and then they can get a higher income. So, you know, and we all fall on the remit, let's pay the right price for the product and have some longevity in there rather than just produce more to consume more and sell more and raise your income that way. I'm jumping way ahead. I've got so excited already. But how did you sort of overcome or get that sort of business narrative taken up within the industries that you've worked with in the baby grow company?
I think that there's probably two answers to that, because the product as a service business model makes a lot of sense and we're starting to have more examples of it, particularly in a B2B context. But looking at the reality we've been talking about, circular economy's theoretical potential for a very long time, yet we've seen very, very little absolute sustainability results. And I think part of that goes to circular economy really being a great tool, but requires that systemic change. So in order for the circular business models to really be incentivized from a business perspective, there is that importance of paying the actual price. So it comes down to a focus on use rather than exchange value. So why do we produce what we do? Why do we build? Having that focus be on use rather than exchange. So it's fine that there's a financial sector that has a return due to the fact that they provide the service of liquidity, but that should be the service industry rather than, if you take the built environment, for instance, that almost being in service of the financial industry to the degree that it's become such an asset class. So that sort of recalibrating the balance between use and exchange value being the one part, and then the other part being, you know, we're starting to talk about the Anthropocene and being in the Anthropocene era and that being defined by what we do as humans affect the planet, which affects our ability to thrive on the planet. So if we take that and internalize that, then the only thing from a sort of rational perspective that makes sense is to have a carbon tax, because otherwise you're working in a market economy where you haven't factored in all the costs. And a market economy can't work without the cost being factored in. So if we want to give sort of market a chance to work, we need a carbon tax, and we need a carbon tax that's actually reflecting the cost it has from an environmental and social perspective. But if we do that and we have that systemic design, then we can really start looking to the experiences and examples of circular business models.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's in the responsible sourcing commodities work that we do. It's about sort of having prices that reflect the true cost, the true value, is about the value of the product and where it comes from and the origins, the social, the environmental, biodiversity, everything within that supply chain coming through. And then how do you educate a consumer to appreciate that value? And there is that whole, like you say, it's a systemic change and we've got to find the right mechanisms to adjust that and to change not only people's perceptions, their education, their willingness, but it's the system, it's the regulatory system, the accounting system that has to come with this and the finance sector. But the Circular Way is your company. When did you set it up and what was your ambition and drive and what do you do as a sort of within the organization?
Yeah, so I think it was about 2015 and it started as a consultancy doing thought leadership, trend forecasting and helping in that regard. Now I actually do very little within the Circular Way. So it's mainly like it talks and stuff like that, because my main focus is cities and buildings. And so having the role of chief innovation and science officer in this the Nordic Hub for Sustainable Urban Development blocks up. So a lot of my time is used there now because there's just a lot of great opportunities there, but I still have the sort of a few engagement on either the thought leadership or the more sort of practical. Someone has to build a building, and then because there's also that, you know, sort of like I want to have the sort of opportunity here of being able to take all of the experiences that we've had in sort of coming from industry myself and utilize that to support all of the sort of the newcomers and the ones that are getting here now, so that we have this sort of scale of things. But at the same time, I also realize that if I'm not getting new knowledge of what it means to be in practice in industry, then it will be difficult to truly provide that service and help elevate them. So I do have these sort of a few things where I see like these are some super interesting developers or this is a super interesting project, and then just doing very sort of mainly just almost having conversations and talking things to do from a strategy perspective.
So do you see an evolution in that sort of, what are we on, sort of 8-9 years time? I mean, do you see a sort of bit more of that systemic change coming? Is it in terms of design, building, construction, where we come? Is there the movement to change?
I think the conversation is definitely starting to happen. But I think we have a huge opportunity and responsibility to really make sure that it doesn't only become about what we are moving away from, but also we start creating these narratives and images and examples of what we might move towards. So that we really start creating those sort of cracks of light where you see new ways of being coming into play and working with that. I guess that's also... Sorry?
Yeah. No, and making it mainstream, because I think there's a real feeling, you know, you look at these design programs or things on television and you're a homeowner and stuff. How do we get that back to being something that everybody can do and participate? And I love the little video you have where you take household waste and you mushed it up and cooked it and then formed a bowl and things like that. And you just think, oh my God, that's so inspiring. But how do we empower or make it something that everybody, in the UK at the moment, we're very like, if you say something, you know, oh, I want to do the right thing. I mean, people think I'm nuts at the moment because I haven't put a gas boiler in my house. So I'm completely mad. And I'm kind of going, I think that should be the normal thing in 10 years' time. Nobody will have a gas boiler in their house. So, like, yeah, how do we support and galvanise that change? And do you see that happening within Denmark?
I think that there are definitely these sort of cracks of lights where it's starting to happen, but there's also still a very long way to go in terms of absolute sustainability. But for me, it's also why I have an interest in not only design, but the Danish design heritage, because I see this sort of that, you know, the design aesthetics of that, that are now very celebrated and has to some degree become a bit elitist, didn't come from that. It came from, you know, building the welfare state, democratizing well-being after the world wars, and really making sure that that, you know, people had what they needed in order to to feel well-being, and that social purpose was part of what created the aesthetic. So that inspiration of saying, wait, we shouldn't see the planetary boundaries as a negative thing that just automatically makes things worse, uglier, more expensive, these types of things, but instead see it as an opportunity to heighten our ambition and create value for people while staying within the planetary boundaries. And that goes to so many different levels. I think there's this sort of, you know, another key learning from the heritage is also a little bit to what you're speaking of, which is sort of that it was also designed that, you know, it was transparent, because there were, you know, there was a care for the materials, for the craft, for the user. It's easy on the eye to see, is this good design or bad? You didn't take like a very long education or the ability to decipher specific cultural codes. You could just see there wasn't this need of all these things on top. And I think in general, also that going back to use value, that would be super useful. But also from a, you know, there's a risk that the sustainability agenda becomes all about carbon capture, for instance. And we might need carbon capture because things have gotten as bad as they have, but that's not the same as carbon capture being the ultimate solution. On the contrary, we really need to go back and have those transparent conversations on what are the good ideas, and that also bringing it back to the sort of innovation by remembrance, all the things we can do with, you know, bio-based materials, eelgrass, algae, wood, all of these things that could actually be carbon capture, but in a natural realm, which would be very cost efficient, very low risk from an innovation perspective, and hopefully from based on that sort of scaling the first generation of biogenic materials, we could think of the sort of the next generation being more bioengineering, so we get even better qualities out of it in terms of built materials and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a very exciting time. It can be incredibly daunting and quite scary, but at the same time, it's exciting. There is innovation. You know, the world is full of incredibly clever people and who have all these amazing ideas. And like you say, looking back and looking at how we've done things in the past, there's a reason why, you know, houses would have been built in a certain way or positioned in a certain place or the way we ate. And it was what was around us and how we could do it. And then we've gone through this sort of globalization and we can get our hands on anything. And it's almost coming back to recognizing and valuing what and how we did things and bringing in that, the new things we've learned, the new ways, the new innovation, the new skills. So it is a great and exciting opportunity in many ways. But where do you sort of see, where are your big frustrations then? I mean, where do you see the sort of limitations and frustrations for moving this agenda forward?
I think one of the things that is both the frustration, but also something that I'm curious about, or that I'm sort of becoming optimistic about, is this sort of, as you spoke to, that there is a lot of, you know, the world is filled with people and human ingenuity and really, really smart people. But it's almost as if since the sort of, 40s, 50s, at least, and maybe a bit before, we've very much sort of grown accustomed to this scientific idea that the further away from natural innovation was, the smarter you were to have been able to create it. And sort of like, you know, as far away from nature, that's the most likely thing to, you know, get you the Nobel Prize or whatnot, and really be seen as extremely as extreme intelligence. And if we instead sort of started looking at, wait, let's combine nature's amazing resources, nature's amazing way of being, nature's resilience with human ingenuity so that we build together rather than apart. And that, I think, is starting to happen. And if we're really, if we push hard for it, then I think that there's a lot of opportunity there. I still think that we need to talk about our systems and that sort of what it means to have entered the Anthropocene in terms of truly pricing the cost of externalities that will have to come into play and recalibrating the system in terms of we are here to create value for people while staying in within the planetary boundaries. And there is room for a financial sector and all these different things, but it needs to be not the top system, but one of several subsystems that work in unity instead.
And without wanting to get political, although it is probably one of my favourite subjects, but I'm going to refrain myself, the political will for change is one of the challenges. And it's natural. We see it as evolution through the generations. When things are tough, when resources are constrained, when finances are constrained, there is a movement to protectionism within a country, put the boundaries up, not engage. And there's an alarming amount of sort of, you know, fake news, disbelief. In the UK, we have a rhetoric around sort of, oh, you can't tell me to eat less, to do less, etc. And industry, though, does want to get on and does want to do change. And it's frustrating because you can kind of go, look, if there was a very clear, strong message coming from our world leaders, whether it was business or government, we could just crack on and get this solved very quickly. I don't know what it's like in Denmark. Do you have the same frustrations that I kind of have? I mean, how do we, I don't know, we've got to work with the politics, but then we also can't be constrained by the politics. And there is a, it, like you say, it's how do we make these things approachable and available to all and just become common sense? And
yeah, and I think that there's right now, politics being as short term as it is a huge problem. We need ambitious, audacious policy leaders. Sort of, there's always this, idea of being inspired by Kennedy and his sort of mission of the moon landing, which I think is a great, it should be a great source of inspiration. We need policymakers that does that. That also means that we need media and us as voters to allow them to do that, realizing that we don't know all the answers, so all answers can't be given. Failure is a necessary part of the road to success. So how do we embrace that both from a policy but also from an industry perspective and allow for that? And there's certainly room for improvement within that. We're not doing that well from a policy perspective, unfortunately. And I think also one thing being mindful of is we can be inspired by Kennedy's moon landing mission, but if we are to, like, the challenge that we have today has the issue of all of the people to whom it will not be beneficial, at least short term, if we are successful with the transformation. So there's a different, there's yeah. different level of barriers than the moon landing. And then also, of course, if you look at what we're facing today, it will be 1,000 or tens of thousands of moon landing that we need to do within a relatively short amount of time. The good thing being then there's more than plenty purpose and opportunity for all of us to engage with.
And we have to do the bits we can do, don't we? And keep plodding and keep expanding. So, I mean, so you've sort of evolved into this role, and I'm just wondering if there have been any women, we're talking about women in sustainability here, that sort of have inspired you along the way, that have led you given you that degree of hope. I note that you work a lot, or you sort of refer to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and I'm a sailor as well as somebody who believes in it. So for me, Ellen is a great source of inspiration. But yeah, just are there people that you've met along the way that you kind of go, that's kind of spurred me on?
I think that there are quite a lot, also like from way back to sort of my grandmother, and then moving forward. Yes, of course, very inspired by Ellen and all of the work that the Ellen MacArthur Foundation does. Also, Christiana Figueres, I think, is one of sort of, she's very good at also articulating sort of the duality of what it means to be alive in the world today. And she has this notion of the need to being a stubborn optimist, which I find a lot of sort of that's a notion that can help me be a part of the world that we face today. I think a woman that's been very influential in what I do now is Helle, she's the CEO and co-founder of GEIL, which is an architectural studio that works very much with cities, and she's also the chair of the board and the sort of the one that thought I should take this role on and sort of scale out the innovation's potential in that sense. So yeah, quite a lot.
And if you had advice for the next generation or more generations, it can be any generation, just in general, for women out there that are keen and interested in this space. I mean, you've got a business background, but that's not limiting in what you're talking about and doing, but it does help and in some of the narrative. I'm an economist by background, but I'm working in the world of sort of deforestation, and people think, well, you're a forester? Nope. what would you say as sort of words of inspiration for women out there that are interested in this?
Yeah, I think that there is, that sort of really following your gut and really going with what feels right. And most likely it is the right thing, and you will also be better at what you do if it's what feels right. So I think that's a key thing. And then being ambitious, that's sort of really daring to say, this is where we need to go. I'm going to push for that, even though sometimes you may be further ahead than others. I think that is key, while at the same time seeing that sort of ecosystem perspective of, you know, maybe being the one that takes the sort of the lead, but also being mindful that there's a lot of other players in the ecosystems, and you probably all need each other. So trying to understand where they're coming from and how, hopefully together, you can solve this sort of one larger solution.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So what next? Where do you go next? I mean, you've just recently published another book, and with your roles on the executive boards and stuff. Is it more of the same, or what's the next? What are the next things on your horizon?
Yeah, that's always a good question. I think having sort of started, you know, like, doing lectures on the book and stuff like that, I realized that I like the role of teaching and sort of being embedded within the communities around science and teaching. So I think that's definitely something to figuring out. How does that work while at the same time, you know, being not necessarily someone that's I enjoy this sort of that I get to have many different roles and seeing things from different perspectives.
So the world's your oyster, and it's you're working beyond the boundaries of Denmark and engaging more on a broader platform, and amazing. Any final thoughts or reflections that you could share with our audience today on this?
I think it's just really that we, you know, it's a little bit going back to Christiana Figueres' notion of a stubborn optimist. I think hope is something that we got to earn. So we got to work hard because no one will do it for us. I believe that we can change for the things for the better, even though there's plenty of reports that might sort of say something different or at least put that into question. But as we talked about, human ingenuity and the natural realm are really, really smart and resilient sources. So if we combine it, I think we can turn this into something better. But it falls upon us to make sure that it happens.
Thank you. Thank you so very, very much for joining us out today and giving us a small glimpse and an insight into the work you're doing. And I do hope we stay in touch and continue to follow your journey and learn. And I'm always found it fascinating when you come from different sectors and yet you've got such commonalities in processes, procedures, issues and opportunities. So yes, a huge thank you. Thank you, Dieter, for joining me, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe, and we hope you can join us soon for another episode. Previous episodes can all be found at our website, www.efica.com.